ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, host of All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, and I have a question for you. Have you ever wondered what is going on inside someone else's head? I think about this a lot because on All in the Mind, we cover psychology and mental health and why people behave the way they do.
How do other people make this decision?
Maybe it's sending a signal to someone about the reliability of someone.
How can this possibly be?
So if you like the sound of that, check out All in the Mind on the ABC Listen app.
In front of you is a beautiful crystal glass, and its long stem reaches up to a generously sized cup. But it's what's inside that really matters. Red wine from France.
It was alleged to be very good claret, very good Bordeaux wine, so not cheap plonk. That was part of the selling point of it.
But the other selling point was what was mixed into this red wine, a substance, a drug, that today could land you in jail.
It's obviously very strong. It's illegal, that goes without saying. And it had this reputation of being the champagne drug. This is all apart from the addiction.
This delicious Bordeaux was infused with cocaine. And the man behind this bizarre concoction? Well, he would find himself the toast of royalty, of presidents, and even the Pope himself.
That's like getting an endorsement from the King of England. He became a millionaire, by the way, so he made a lot of money out of this.
I'm Mark Fennell, and consider this your warning, by the way. This episode is a saga of drugs that today might be illegal, but once upon a time, everyone from kids to kings consumed it. It's a story of ancient knowledge that would be co-opted by some very modern marketing techniques that we still use today. And ultimately, it would lead to the world's most popular soft drink. And no one saw it coming. Alright, I want you to imagine that you are standing on the edge of the ocean and you're looking out at the English Channel, right? The weather? Yeah, it's not great. The year is 1909 and in front of you is a very sturdy looking Frenchman with a plan.
He was an inventor and he got into building early aeroplanes.
His name is Louis Blériot and he is about to become the first person to fly across the English Channel. Though perhaps not quite flying as we experience it today.
The aircraft flew very slowly at about 45 miles an hour, so not fast. I've done this in 1994, 85 years later. I flew a flexwing microlight.
Which is, let's say, an adventurous thing for Dr. Tim Madge to do. So Tim Madge is the voice telling the story, and Tim has a knack for the adventurous.
Well, I'm a writer. I've really had three careers. I've had a career as a journalist. I've worked for all the broadsheets in Britain. On the back of that, I decided I wanted to concentrate on full-time writing. I'm a bit of a butterfly when it comes to writing, so I write what interests me at the time.
Butterfly. Excellent. Stealing that from my LinkedIn. All right. So Tim is a full-time writer, and this is around the 1990s, and he notices something. The tabloids in the UK, they are obsessed with supermodels and nightlife and who's seen leaving which club at 3 a.m. And running through all of it in the gossip columns and scandal stories and 1,000 knowing winks. One particular drug, he notices, is having a very fashionable moment. Cocaine. It's in the headlines, it's in the clubs, it's part of the mythology of excess that defined the 90s. And Tim, of course, being an enterprising author, he looks at all of this and he thinks,
why don't we write a book about cocaine? It's in the headlines a lot, who'd taken it and the scandals around it. And it had this reputation of being the champagne drug. You know, if you could afford it, you'd made it in some kind of a way. This is all apart from the addiction. So on the back of that, the more I got into it, the more interesting the story became.
But where do you begin to tell the story of what was then at least the world's most fashionable drug? Which, by the way, kids / ABC lawyers listening, don't do these drugs. All right? Anyways, following the lines, See what I did there? All the way back. Tim traces the story of cocaine, not to the 90s, beyond the nightclubs and the tabloids. He goes all the way back to 1909, to that Frenchman that we met earlier, Louis Blériot. He's got a magnificent bushy moustache. He's got goggles on, determination, and he's sitting in what can only be generously described as an aeroplane. We're talking woods, wires. This is a fragile lattice of canvas and hope. And he's about to attempt this first flight across the English Channel, a journey so risky that many people at the time consider him less of an aviator and more of a madman with excellent facial hair.
The Wright brothers, who basically invented modern aviation, had also been asked if they would attempt it. And they said, no thanks, it's too dangerous.
Always a great sign. Anyway, Blériot, unfazed, he readies his plane. And then up he goes. The flimsy craft takes to the sky. And when I say sky, I mean the sky is barely in the air.
And at that height above the water, he would have seen that the horizon ahead of him, halfway across, he got into cloud and he had to keep going blind. It was a very brave thing to do. And he was the first, let's face it. Aviation has come on so fast and so far since then. So he was a brave man.
But what, you may ask, is fueling this bravery? Well, in Blériot's pocket is a hip flask. And inside that hip flask,
it was said to contain very good Bordeaux, like claret, so red wine, and coca leaves. The wine was steeped in coca leaves, and coca leaves would have had this small content of psychoactive substance, which we now know as cocaine.
Yes, the first air crossing of the English Channel in a plane was done by a pilot who was both drunk and high on cocaine. Again, I cannot stress this enough, please do not do this at home. The drink itself was known as Vin Mariani, and it's probably worth caveating that he didn't have very much of it in his system.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this, and he would have had his hands full. I think he might have had a bit of a swig of it before he took off. Then he would have probably had it in the airplane with him. But as to whether he actually used it on the flight, he would have had his hands and feet quite full. I don't know. And I suspect when he got to the other side, he probably drank a lot of champagne. But off the back of this flight, he wrote an endorsement to Angelo Mariani, who was still around at the time, and said, do you want me to read what he said?
I would love it. I mean, we're not normally supposed to have advertising on the ABC, but I think we'll make an exception for this one.
Well, this wine no longer exists. So Blériot said, I took the precaution of bringing a small flask of Mariani wine along with me, and it was a great help. Its energetic action sustained me during the crossing of the channel.
So in case you haven't picked up on this yet, Vin Mariani was actually named after a person, its creator, a French chemist known as Angelo Mariani.
He's a classic Victorian gent.
Which I think is code for more excellent facial hair. Anyways, before Mariani got this thrilling endorsement from our tipsy French pilot, decades earlier, he was just a chemist trying to create a drink that helped people forget their hunger and fatigue. And so he created Vin Mariani. Vin being French for wine.
Kind of fortified wine. It was said to contain very good Bordeaux, like claret, and coca leaves.
So basically, it's a wine that's been infused with the coca leaf, which is the building blocks of cocaine.
Cocaine is derived from the coca plant, and it has a very small content in the plant, so you have to do a lot of refining.
Now, let's take a second to zoom out here, because to understand all of this, you kind of need to understand the plant itself. For thousands of years, coca had been used across what is now, I guess, Peru, Colombia, Bolivia, and people chewed on the leaves as a medicine and also a stimulant to lift mood, aid digestion, suppress appetite, and just generally cope with life at crazy high altitudes. It was not a scandal, it was not a taboo, it was everyday life. Then, in the 16th century, European explorers, they encounter coca. They took note of how it was being used. And then in the next sort of 200 years or so, Europe begins to develop a full-blown fascination with exotic plants and their effects on the human body. In the 1800s, you got botanists and doctors and entrepreneurs, and everyone's experimenting, everyone's curious, and coca begins to make its way into Western medicine, which is how we hit the 1860s, where a 25-year-old Angelo Mariani decides to create something entirely new, coca-infused wine.
He was a Corsican, and Corsicans like to think of themselves as a bit different. Napoleon Bonaparte.
I was going to say Napoleon would be the most famous example of that.
So they're a bit mavericky. Mariani got very interested in the leaf, and he became actually a world expert over time.
Yeah, so at that point, Europeans were really figuring out how to consume the coca leaf. Mostly they were chewing on it to get its effects.
Which was exactly what the Peruvians and originally the Incas, who saw it as a sacred plant, that's what they used to do.
But there's a drawback to this way of consuming the plant. It's quite bitter for the European palate. Mariani thought there has to be a better, more delicious way to consume this leaf and still get high.
And then he had the brilliant idea. You could take some of the bitterness out if you put it in wine. And that's what he did.
And so Vin Mariani was born. Now, initially, he started marketing it as a tonic wine, sort of more medicinal than your usual Friday night glass of red.
There was a lot of interest in the 19th century. Again, you have to go back and think about the state of medicine. There were no antibiotics. Doctors were using techniques that they used in the Middle Ages for like cupping and leeches. So the idea that there were other means of becoming healthy or staying healthy was a huge interest to people at the time, and they were looking for a panacea, a kind of cure-all, and they looked at these various kinds of concoctions, and this just hit the spot.
I'll bet it did. Right now it's the middle of the night, so I have a coffee cup, but let's, for argument's sake, imagine that it is filled with Vin Mariani. Like, how much cocaine am I getting in a glass of my tonic wine, my cocaine wine?
I would speculate you're getting probably the same. If that's black coffee, you're probably getting something similar, except that we're so used to drinking coffee that we don't get the same sort of reaction to it as people would have done at the time. He suggested that people who bought his wine had three, I think you'd probably call them medium to large glasses a day. So presumably one at breakfast, one at lunch, and one in the evening. And I calculated when I was doing the book that if you did that, you'd get quite a belt, more akin to some of the modern caffeine booster drinks that are on the market.
Right. So it's more like the buzz you get from one of those fluorescent energy drinks. The buzz and the feeling of an impending heart attack. Anyways, the interesting thing about this combination of wine and coca leaves is that Mariani, as a chemist, would have learnt that the ethanol in the wine operated as a solvent, which extracted the cocaine from the leaf. Now, when the alcohol and the cocaine are combined, you actually get a third compound, which is coca ethylene. When that's metabolised, its effect on the body is it's more euphoric and more powerful than the cocaine and the alcohol alone, which is all very interesting and academic. But I know the real question you want to ask, which is, did it taste good?
That's a very good question. Because it was very good, it was alleged to be very good claret, very good Bordeaux wine, so not cheap plonk. That was part of the selling point of it. I think it would have had a slightly odd taste, to be honest with you, because I think good Bordeaux mixed with anything is going to taste not quite right. But obviously it worked because it was so popular. So I have to say, it's one of those questions that you'd have to put down to, we won't ever really quite know. But he did do a lot of experiments. So it's not just like a one-off. You dunk the leaves in the wine and then and see what happens. He was a chemist and he would have experimented a great deal in the early days to get this just right.
Do you reckon, would Vin Mariani have been addictive in any way?
No, absolutely not. if you think there's an argument now about energy drinks and whether they are addictive, but they have far more content of caffeine content in them than this would have had a cocaine content.
So he has created a product that gets people jazzed and wired. And he's pitched it as a tonic wine, making people feel like it's a good thing for their health. Then it came time to sell the thing. Now, this is where I think you see Mariani's real skill set.
And then he was an absolute genius at marketing. So he didn't just put this stuff on the market. He started to send free samples to people, and they would be the celebrities of today. We think of celebrities as pop stars and models and people who just call themselves celebrities. But the celebrities of the day would have been people like kings and queens and what have you. And he started to send cases of wine to all these people. And he got quite a few letters of, well, endorsement letters, basically, from people saying, this stuff is wonderful.
It's worth looking at the guest list here, because these aren't minor influencers. This is the 19th century equivalent of global superstars.
Just a few names. Alexandre Dumas, the novelist in France, wrote to him, "Mariani, your sweet flasks delight my mouth." Thomas Edison, "Monsieur Mariani, I take pleasure in sending you one of my photographs for publication in your album, yours very truly." The Lumiere brothers, who were early pioneers of cinema, said, "To our friend Mariani, whose wine gives us strength." Jules Verne, the novelist, said, "Since a single bottle of Mariani's extraordinary coca wine guarantees a lifetime of 100 years, I shall be obliged to live to the year 2700. Well, I have no objections. Yours very gratefully."
There are presidents as well, aren't there?
Yeah. Ulysses Grant, who was a general in the Civil War, then became president. He used to take a teaspoon of the wine, and it said that he wouldn't have finished his memoirs if he hadn't done that, because he actually had throat cancer at the time. President McKinley was another one. According to what I've got in front of me here, Russian czars were fans, as was the Prince of Wales in Britain.
And then Mariani gave his wine to someone so admired, so revered, so holy, that the mere thought of it today feels like sacrilege.
Angelo Mariani was an assiduous marketer, and among the people he sent a case of his wine to was Pope Leo XIII. And Leo XIII obviously enjoyed the contents of the case of wine that he got sent, and he sent Mariani a gold medal. He sent a cardinal to deliver it to Mariani in Paris. And he wrote a letter to him, and he said, the letter says, "His Holiness has deigned to commission me to thank the distinguished donor in his holy name and to demonstrate his gratitude in a material way as well. His Holiness does me the honor of presenting Monsieur Mariani with a gold medal containing his coat of arms." So that's quite something. I mean, the Pope was quite a big noise in late 19th century Europe. So no small deal. That's like getting an endorsement from the King of England.
Mariani is fascinating to me for a bunch of reasons, not just the drug history, but also the marketing history, right? Because he pulls off what feels like a very modern pivot. He starts out selling this cheap cure-all for the desperate, and then he cleverly rebrands it as a tonic for high-powered people under pressure. It's not about illness, it's about performance, energy, focus, creativity. He's targeting intellectuals, politicians, artists, performers, basically saying this will fuel you, which starts to sound suspiciously like the pitch behind every energy drink you've ever seen, right? Except this one came in a wine bottle.
Yeah, absolutely. He became a millionaire, by the way, so he made a lot of money out of this.
So Mariani's tonic wine is an absolute hit. You got your royalties, popes, presidents, they're drinking it, they're loving it, they're endorsing it. Not only does he become insanely rich because of it, but there's this curious cultural side effect, right, where it helps normalize cocaine. In the early 1900s, you could buy powdered cocaine, cocaine throat lozenges over the counter, and in a way, Van Mariani, it's like the tip of the sword of that acceptance that is then built on by others, including, arguably, the world's most famous mental health professional.
It was down to Sigmund Freud, who came across it, changed his kind of perspective in lots of respects, and he got hold of the pure stuff, and he went a bit mental, really, for it. And he was giving it to everybody and saying it was the panacea. And there was this bizarre theory that cocaine was a cure for morphine addiction. And of course it isn't.
But that's not the end of Mariani's influence. No, no. Because this story has another twist. Van Mariani also helps inspire what would eventually become, arguably, the most famous soft drink in the world.
Yes, it does indeed.
In the United States, at this point, you have a man who is deeply addicted to morphine. His name is John Pemberton. He'd been badly wounded in the Civil War, got prescribed morphine, like a lot of vets, never really managed to get off it. But in 1886, he's looking for a way to change his life, maybe find a safer alternative. And Pemberton decides to invent a drink.
He was looking at how he could produce a cola drink. There were lots of them on the market, similar sort of thing, tonic drinks. And he tried Van Mariani and obviously got the inspiration. I don't think there's any doubt that he got it from Van Mariani. And he then, the original Coca-Cola, he added cola nuts to it, which have got caffeine in. So you've got alcohol, caffeine, and a minute dose of cocaine. So it was powerful stuff.
Van Mariani was his inspiration. But unlike Mariani's drink, which was wine, Pemberton's concoction was a syrup to be mixed with soda and sold for 5 cents a glass as a soda fountain drink. Which was, by the way, soda fountain drinks. Oh, that was a whole thing back then.
So you go into these elaborate, like, modern versions of a coffee shop, and there'd be this extraordinary fairground machine in front of you with all these taps and whatever, and you would ask for a shot of Coca-Cola. It would be like a little shot of, like a shot glass, and then they would pour it into a bigger glass, and they would whiz in the soda, so it fizzes all up. And obviously people were asking for, as people do, the equivalent of a double and a treble espresso. And so they were getting, and again, I calculated they were getting a pretty hefty belt of all of these substances together.
Now, this notion that Coca-Cola originally had cocaine in it, it's been around a long time. You've probably heard it before. The truth is the reality of it is actually so much more full on because, like, imagine young Americans hitting the soda fountain. What they're getting is a hit of cocaine, alcohol, and caffeine. That's a lot. Alas, though, the recipe did not last. Because of the temperance movement, Pemberton took the alcohol out of it, and eventually the cocaine came out too. And 2 years after creating his new Coca-Cola drink, Pemberton died. But the Coca-Cola company went on to a man named Asa Candler.
And this guy was a marketing genius. And I think that a very similar story to Van Mariani. They were very innovative as well. They introduced bottling quite early on. So they got away from the shots and the soda fountain, and it was in bottles. So it was standardized across the entire United States and then obviously everywhere else as well.
Less than a decade later, Coca-Cola had grown so quickly, it was being sold in every state and territory in the US. And there's this strange, almost inverse relationship between Van Mariani and Coca-Cola. As one rises, the other quietly disappears. Van Mariani fades from shelves. Coca-Cola, meanwhile, keeps evolving, keeps expanding, eventually becoming one of, if not the biggest soft drink company in the world. Today, it sells more than 1 billion drinks a day in over 200 countries. But for Tim Madge, who stumbled across the story of Van Mariani years ago, this isn't just a quirky footnote in marketing history. No, no, no. This is a story about ancient knowledge and what happens when indigenous practices are noticed, adapted, and transformed by the wider world.
I think it's an example of the West or Europe and then America learning that there's more out there than you anticipate. And we're still doing it. We're still discovering drugs that you can make from plants used in the Amazonian forest and have been for centuries. this man took a product from a faraway land, blended it with something that was been known about in Europe for centuries, and created something very special. And we have a lot to thank him for, because out of that came, indirectly, Coca-Cola and all the other sort of fizzy drinks we enjoy today.
Tim, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been nice to meet you.
Tim Matsch is an author, former journalist, and all-round butterfly. This episode was produced by Rebecca Metcalf and Zoe Ferguson. The sound engineer was Andy Grant. No One Saw It Coming. It is made on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia, for ABC Radio National. My name is Mark Fennell, and thank you for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.